Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. One o'clock on the East Coast. Sorry, I'm a little bit late there. G-Swizz here. Dan Nathan there. Carter Braxton-Worth will be joining us. Now, April, this is a futures day, is letter J. The letter J, just in case any people were wondering out there. Dan, I know you were wondering. It is April 1st. It was a glorious weekend. The Rangers of New York put on just a drubbing in Arizona. The Yankees swept the four-game set in Houston. And the Mets got swept. Let me repeat, the Mets were swept at home, which I got to tell you something, is the highlight of my weekend. How are you, Dan?
I'm doing great. You know, guy.
I'm a hater.
Well, you know what? It was a nice long holiday weekend, which was excellent. And there was some data on Good Friday, which I think got a lot of like the Bulls all geeked up. I guess it was benign, guy. It was benign inflation data. It depends how you look at it. Depends how you read it. There's also Fed Chair Powell had some pretty positive things to say about the economy on Friday morning. So I know that a lot of folks were just giddy with anticipation to get to Monday and see how the futures would open here. But there, I don't know, a whole lot of nothing, which is kind of what we said last week. But the one thing I will say is that they're a whole lot of nothing and lower. So that's a little different. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a whole lot of nothing and low. Listen, it's a pretty benign day if you look at the S&P. The S&P is down, 0.3% or so. I would not characterize that as a big deal. The NASDAQ's effectively unchanged. Yeah, and the Dow's down maybe 0.2%. So I get it. With that said, you know, the VIX is up almost one entire point. You know, we were north of 14 at one point. So it's an outsized move, in my opinion, in the VIX, given what's going on. But let's take a look at today's rundown, Dan, because I don't want to completely bore people. And here we go. The other thing, yields are spiking without question. I mean, that to me is the biggest story of the day. Beware my gold breakout. See, if I said guy's gold breakout, that would be me speaking in third person, which would be weird. Carter charts the mega trend stocks. And of course, what we're watching, we do that in the Instagram each day. We're both on the gram, by the way, as you know.
Yeah, you are Guy.Adami. I'm Dan S. Nathan, and we have At Risk Reversal Media. And every morning, our team puts out a little something that you and I are focused on. So we're going to get that at the end of this program. Let's talk about this yield spike. So one thing that is not benign is the move in the 10-year yield. Okay, so 4.32. And you know, it's interesting to me because you would have thought that if you had benign inflation data, that PCE reading, that you'd see weakness in yields, guys. So what's going on right here? And what would be the catalyst to press yields above that sort of double top? Was that 4.45 or something like that?
Okay. There's a lot there, and Carter has thoughts, I'm sure. But to answer your question specifically, okay, I'll accept benign, although quite frankly, I thought it was a little hot. But let's just say that the data was benign. What you read about over the weekend and what you've been reading more and more about is the U.S. debt. U.S. debt to GDP and the amount and just in interest payments, you know, interest that we have to pay on that debt, staggering numbers. And I think the market's coming to the realization that, hey, we have to roll over some paper this year into the magnitude of anywhere between $9 and $10 trillion. And the market's going to demand higher rates if they're going to buy that debt. The market will consume U.S. debt. That's not what I'm saying. It's just the rate with which they do it. And I think to a certain extent, you're seeing it today. So it's interesting that yields are higher, gold is higher, you know, the dollar against the yen is higher. I mean, there are a lot of weird things going on today. So it's important to look at this. Now, you're right to point out, and if we draw a horizontal line across these tops, you'll see that, you know, 435-ish or so, maybe close to 440, that's been pretty big resistance. But, you know, what I'll continue to tell you is since December, you know, we've been either side of the 200-day moving average. The 200-day moving average is still slightly towards an upward bend, which I think if you think yields are going higher is encouraging. You know, and I'm still one of the few people out there, correctly or incorrectly, that thinks yields go higher the rest of the year.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, so, you know, you're talking about this relationship with gold, too. And you highlighted earlier, there's a guy named Tavi Costa, who's a really good feed on the Twitter, if you're still on there. But this is like, Tavi must be a fan of the On the Tape podcast and the Market Call guy, because this is what I think you've been saying for an awfully long time as it relates to gold, almost in very similar terms. Central banks are starting to show their cards, and the surge in gold prices has been relentless. It's remarkable to see the price behavior on days when treasuries fall and inflation expectations rise. The race to improve the quality of the international reserves is just getting started. You've been saying that for a long time. You've been quoting, I think on a monthly basis for probably 2 years or so, Guy, how much central banks have been buying of gold. Now, about a year ago, I was wondering why Guy kept on talking about this when gold couldn't get out of its own way. Maybe let's pull up a gold chart here for a second. But your point, and you don't always have to be right on price, right, to be right about what's going on? What are some of the, and you know, this is one of those sort of macro risk assets where I guess it does make sense to pay attention to the reasons why whoever's buying it or selling it or doing what they're doing, right? And listen, none of them are going to come out and tell you what they're doing, but the act of them doing it might be telling you something about other risk assets that you're investing.
Well, look, they're not going to say the reasons why without question, but to me, it was interesting. Again, you know, we have mentioned a number of times, 2022, 2023, this year as well. You know, central banks, and the phrase that I use, and this will catch on at some point, but they're hedging their ineptitude. And I think that's exactly what's going on. And if you go back to that prior slide, you know, you'll see the decoupling that's been taking place in terms of yields and in terms of gold. I mean, yields, obviously, through the lens of the TLT. So TLT going lower obviously means yields going higher. That's the red. The white, obviously, is gold. And that started happening, I don't know, you know, early on in the COVID scare, I guess, early 2020, mid 2020. So something is going on here. I still think, again, I'm not suggesting I'm right, but the yen weakness is something I think more and more people are going to start to talk about. And I think the gold party is just on the precipice of getting started. And I don't, and I've said for a while, you know, at a certain point, the dollar strength headwind will abate in terms of what's going on. I think the dollar strength will continue. And the yield weakness, or the yield, however you want to look at, yields going higher will no longer be sort of a detriment to gold as well. And you're starting to see it in spades here, Dan.
Yeah, you know, so it's interesting, Guy, though. You would think that, again, if central banks were hedging against their own ineptitude, okay, you know, it's interesting that, you know, yields, and Carter had a great note out on Worth Charting earlier today talking about how the 10-year yield is basically the exact same spot it was a year ago. Now, we've had plenty of volatility. We had that move from 3.5 to 5 down to 380, and here we are at 430. Okay, so we get it. Okay, but you know, you can take a look here and you can see, well, we're a bit higher, but whatever the framework that he used. So let me ask you this though, because coming into this year, okay, and you can see that, you know, the 10-year yield was just a little bit below here, right? At that time, there were 6 rate cuts priced in, okay, if you're looking at the swaps, if you're looking at CME Fed Funds Tracker, whatever you're looking at, okay? Now we have 3. And then if we want to pull up for the June meeting, because this was above 60-some% or so probability of a 25 basis point cut at the June meeting, now it's down to like 56% there, if you see that, right? And so it really feels like we're a couple benign to hotter, if you want to interpret the PCE that way, as you did, you know what I mean, prints away from June being priced out for a cut.
If you think that rate cuts are some panacea for the market, and again, we've illustrated, we've shown, Doug Cass has written about it, we've put up slides that, you know, typically when they start cutting is actually the wrong time to be bullish. Now, the pushback, well, that will be, well, because historically they've had a cut because something is breaking, and that's why the market. So I get all those arguments. However, I'll say this as well. At some point this year, and I think we're starting to see it on the, you're going to start pricing in at a very low rate, you know, probably less than 10%, the chance for a rate hike this year. So don't put that, you know, don't completely dismiss that. And I'm not saying it's going to happen. I want to be crystal freaking clear.
Yeah.
But I think the market, in terms of 6 rate cuts this year, got way ahead of themselves. And I think 3 is probably still way too optimistic. And I think it's probably going to be closer to one or two, Dan.
Yeah, there. So this is Carter's note right here, and I think it's kind of interesting. Again, you know, he's kind of highlighting that 4-1-1 level. We're a bit above that now. We're having a big move here, if you look at it, right? Like on a day like today.
There we are.
Yeah, they'll move like that. So I think that's interesting. You know, guys, the one thing I'll just say is that if we go from pricing 6 to 3 cuts, okay, pushing those out, and then it starts looking like the Fed may have to, you know, like raise again, okay, after the one of the, I think Liz Young was on the pod with me this morning, the On the Tape podcast, talked about if we don't raise, if there is not a cut, okay, until the November meeting, let's say these cuts get pushed out, that's going to be like the longest pause after a rate hiking cycle. And again, my point is if they go from that to then actually doing an about face and raising interest rates again, there's a couple of ways to think about this, okay? Inflation might be hot, but the economy is running hot, okay? And so then let's say China is like, you saw those PMIs data out of China over the weekend. So they're out of contraction, the highest reading in a year. That will only kind of spur some of the inflationary pressures that you have in commodities, industrial commodities and the like here. And then you say to yourself, all right, so the Fed actually higher for longer is real. And Guy Adami was Nostradami and is right, because if the Fed has to start raising again, but I cannot imagine, Guy, under what scenario that would be good for equities that have had this unabated period without a 2% one day close lower, right? We're like 285 days or something like that. It just feels like something would have to give at that point.
Now, look, I think you make a good point. Again, the bulls will say, well, wait a second, Dan, wait a second, Guy. The reason why they're going to have to raise rates, and again, we're not saying this is going to happen, but that under that scenario, it's because things are going so well. The economy is so strong. And theoretically, a strong economy should mean strong earnings, strong revenue, which should basically help the multiple that people are willing to pay for a dollar's worth of earnings in the form of the S&P. So I'm sure there will be some that look at that through the bullish lens. You know, I think it's going to be more inflationary pressures that make, and the other things that I mentioned earlier in the show, as opposed to a strong economy. And I think that's one of the reasons I've been so concerned. Now, the optimist will say, no, you're missing the point. It's because the things are so strong. The economy is so resilient. That's why stocks are being bought. And that's why rates are staying high. You know, I can understand that argument. I don't adhere to it, but I understand it.
Yeah, but the last thing I'll just say is that we keep having earnings estimates for the S&P come in better than expected. We keep having GDP, you know, ratcheted up at least above expectations. And so until we get some really important companies, and we might get them. Listen, you know, earnings start, you know, next week, next Friday, right? We have Wells Fargo, Citibank, JP Morgan get things kicked off. The next week, I'm sure there'll be a few tech names and the like, and then we're going to get into some industrials. I'm sure... You know, like, listen, if we go through this period where, and we track John Butter's work every week, right, from Earnings Insight, the blog over there at FactSet, let's just say we're in this normal period where earnings estimates come down over the course of the quarter, right, and then they come in better than expected, and we keep doing that, and there's more confidence in this, like, 10% expected EPS growth. The problem is at $243 in earnings, you can do the math on where the S&P is trading at 21 times right now, right? You know what I mean? Like, and so it does get expensive at some point, but if you don't have earnings guide downs, then you probably have a market that continues to, right? Like to just
no, it's, listen, it's all fair. I mean, everything has lasted a lot longer than I thought. Whatever lag effect, you know, these long and variable lags, I mean, they seem to get longer and more variable with each passing day. And that is the bull case that, you know, we sort of grind through this thing, and the market really did, rates really didn't matter for the broader market. And we'll see if that's the case. I mean, again, you know, we're talking about things that we probably have never seen before. It doesn't mean it can't happen, but there is a euphoria in the market. And, you know, we both got to know a gentleman named Tobias Levkovich from Citi, and he was a legend in our world, and we lost him a few years ago. But look at this note from Citi, Dan, because this speaks to, you know, some of the other things we've talked about, some of the things that Doug Cass has pointed out, sort of this euphoria and optimism in the market. And, you know, again, all these different indicators, and there are a number of different ones, are seemingly continue to flash red. The market, you know, today notwithstanding, doesn't seem to care.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't know that they named this index after him, which I think is a really nice. I mean, he was one of the most thoughtful strategists I think you and I had really come across. And he did a lot of obviously very quantitative work. And so I think a lot of those inputs are going into this index, and basically you can read what it says on the screen, but they're basically hitting euphoria sort of readings. Our friend Peter Buchvar of Bleakley Advisors pointed it out this morning on his note on the book report. And again, it's talking about what the potential are for forward returns, and you could, you know, it could suggest that 9% lower from here. And it is pretty remarkable to think about that we're one quarter in 2024, guy, and we've already had, you know, this 10% higher, you know, for the S&P 500, which, you know, to me is really interesting that the S&P 500 has outpaced the NASDAQ year to date. When you think of the outperformance in semi names, the fact that an NVIDIA this year has gained $1 trillion in market cap, it's nearly overtaken Apple. Think about that. It's nearly overtaken Apple in market cap terms. So obviously this 90% expected EPS growth from NVIDIA helps a whole heck of a lot in the S&P 500. Microsoft and, you know, some of these other large mega cap names helping a lot. But this morning, there's a note out, I think it was Loop Capital, you showed it to me, where they're suggesting that Apple actually earnings growth could go negative this year. And so to me, you know, so the fact that the S&P is outperforming the NASDAQ year to date, you've lost a name like Apple, you've lost a name like Tesla, which is down 30% on the year, hasn't seen an uptick in weeks, it doesn't seem like. But you still have the S&P broadening out. I guess that is the notion that you would have here, right? So talk to me a little bit about that, because you know, you could say it is bullish, but you could also say when we started naming, you know, the Mag 7, right? And now it's the Fab 4. What is going to be the terrible three? I don't know. You know what I mean? Like sooner or later, once you lose all of those, there's not much to hope for anymore, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, noted. And again, if you had told me, you know, little information is dangerous, how poorly Apple would be trading, and then asked me, okay, then subsequently tell me what the broader market's going to do, I'd be like, we'd be significantly lower. I mean, when I say significantly lower, you know, we'd be from 4,200, maybe we'd be 4,750, 4,800 in the S&P. Obviously, we're nowhere near that. And here's the S&P E-mini futures. I mean, if you look at it, this trend line continues to be intact without question. There's nothing not to like here except one thing, you know, the distance with which we are away from that moving average. You know, the mean reversion, I think, comes in. And it's interesting, if you go back to that prior note, their suggestion was sort of 4780 or so. I think that's what, yeah, it's look at me with a great memory. 4780 was sort of a level. And if you go back to the chart that we just had on, you'll see that's pretty much where the moving average will probably come in by the time we get there. I mean, this continues to slope higher. And over time, you know, 4780 makes a lot of sense. But pull up Apple real quick with that chart. And again, Apple's up there, so you know it's Apple. But let's pretend for a second that you didn't know this was Apple. And I said, okay, here's the chart of whatever. And then I'll also tell you that this is a company that trades probably close to 28 times next year's numbers, has mid-single-digit EPS and revenue growth with margins that have been flatlining for the last couple of years. And obviously, they also have a bit of a China problem. And then you see this chart, and then you take everything into consideration, what I just told you, you're like, holy shit, this looks terrible, right? The only thing that sways you a bit is knowing this is Apple. And I'm not saying you, I'm just saying people in the market in general. They're obviously continue to be sort of seduced by the fact that, oh, wait a second, it's Apple, it must be different. I'm here to tell you that it's probably not different.
You know, it's interesting, guy, and you've talked about these sell-offs in the past. So last year, from the highs in the S&P in July to the lows in late October, you know, Apple sold off about 16% or so. It's down about 15% from the recent all-time high. So it made a brief new all-time high, I think, at the end of February. The move from the all-time high in early 2022 to the lows in early 2023 was about 33% or so. So right now, when you stack it up, the relative underperformance of Apple versus, let's say, the broad market, but then other mega cap stories in tech that are attached to generative AI, you say to yourself, man, if they don't get their act together, if they don't have a proper announcement in generative AI by the Worldwide Developers Forum on June 10th, right? There was rumors that they might partner with Gemini, which is obviously Alphabet's large language model. You say to yourself, this thing could be on its way to a down 30% sort of move. Now, the flip side of that is that if the company were to kind of announce some sorts of deals that would give you confidence in a re-acceleration of demand for iPhones, because let's just say they're going to start integrating AI through the cloud, which would be Gemini, right, onto their next iOS or something. And let's say they detail that in June. And let's just say that we know that they have these great like chip making design that they've been doing on their own. And they're basically able to do a bunch of AI processes on the device. Let's just say this is part of the thing they're going to map it out to. You're already seeing Samsung advertise some of their own products like this. Then you could say, okay, you're going to hear it again. And you know, I think this is totally BS, but all the analysts who talk about the upgrade super cycles in iPhones, we've been hearing it again and again. That will be the narrative. And at some point, it won't be hard to see this stock back at $195. You know, right. Does that make some sense to you?
It makes, and go back to that prior chart, because this is, it looks like the treasury chart with the gold chart, if you think about it, you know, the decoupling that's been taking place. I mean, you can see it as clear as day. The green, obviously, the S&P, which has been unabated to the upside. Obviously, things sort of went askew earlier this year, to a certain extent earlier this year, in terms of Apple and the S&P 500. So how does it resolve itself? Well, you know, how does the treasury gold thing resolve itself? We'll find out. Does it resolve itself at all? How does this resolve itself? Is it in the form of that June 10th announcement? Does Apple bottom that day and then basically do the catch-up trade to the broader market? I obviously don't know the answer to that. I wish I did, you know, but I'm telling you that right now, here and today, Apple is obviously a bit of a story that nobody seems to be talking about, because let's put it this way. If semis didn't exist, if NVIDIA and some of these other names didn't exist, and we're going to talk about Eli Lilly in a second, I think you'd be hearing about Apple a lot more than you have. The only reason you don't hear about it is because other things are sort of taking the spotlight right now. So they're sort of incubated by, or they're protected by, the strength in these other stocks, the reason why Apple isn't a huge point of conversation.
Yeah, this might come as a surprise to you. You know,
if the audience.
Well, to you and maybe the audience. If the S&P were to sell off, let's just say we got that 9% sell off, okay? And listen, people, it's not unheard of, okay? Again, just go back and look at last.
Well, that's like that scene in Major League, you know, when the manager's in the if we win one game tomorrow, that's a win. If we win again the next day, that's what you call winning streak. It's happened before. I love that. We'll put it in the show notes. Sorry. Anyway,
it has happened before, but if the broad market were to sell off, and let's just say there's just nothing on the product front, you know, and Apple's going to report in about a month or so, and let's just say they have no announcement with any like licensing of any, you know, OpenAI or Gemini or nothing. There's nothing there. And let's just say China's really weak, and let's say iPhones miss, and let's say new iPads and Macs are not enough, and Vision Pro was a bomb, and all this sort of stuff. And let's just say Apple does go down, you know, another 10% or so. Then I think it's a layup of buy. I really do. Mm-hmm. If you get this thing, okay, down towards, I don't know, below 160 or so, guy, or, you know, like, I just think you start scaling into it a little bit, because there will be an announcement, and then people will give them the benefit of the doubt if they do the right partnership. Do you know what I'm saying? And again, and it doesn't mean, but so, you know, it doesn't mean that there's going to be anything in the Apple stores, you know, coming September or anything like that. But my point is, it'll probably be a good place to start legging into it. After earnings, if it is a disappointment without any announcements, it will run into worldwide developers.
Okay. World. And I don't want to, we have other things to talk about, so I don't want to sort of, you know, go overdo it here. Yeah. But think about this just for a second. As we've mentioned, the number of ETFs that Apple is in, I think they're one of the top 15 holdings in about 314 or so ETFs. So Apple wins when the market goes sideways to higher, just on the back of money flows, right? If you think about it, whether you realize it or not, money is flowing in. So Apple has done this, made this move with the broader market that's done what it's done. So think about what would be happening if the broader market were selling off as well, and people selling those ETFs. It's just something to think about. Anyway.
Well, the passive, I mean, listen, you make a great point. That passive nature about it is the thing that, you know, even if you were expecting maybe Apple, because of its underperformance now, to outperform, you know, for a whole host of reasons, if the market was in a proper sell-off. So I get it. I want to quickly go back to the S&P futures here, and maybe they can pull up like a 5 or 10 day chart. I just want to show what looks to be a little bit of a consolidation in the S&P. All right. So you see that little sideways action above that uptrend line that's been in place there. And now they're just going to kind of spread it out. You know, guy, we just kind of made that new intraday high. You see that we reversed kind of hard. I think it has to do with the reversal in yields. You know, this is one where today, heading into the close, like if I'm trading the futures here, I might look to put them out. Let's say we get an intraday rally in the next, let's say, hour or two or something like that. I may look to sell some S&P mini futures here and stop them right about at the prior all-time high, okay? So that we saw this morning, okay? And you can do the math. It's kind of like, I don't know, this morning we opened at 5314. The high was 5333, okay? And here we are. We're trading at about 5290 or so, right? So I'm going to stop myself out up 40 handles or something like that and look to play for a move. And I would continue to lower that stop. And then let's spread this out a little bit. Let's go back to that uptrend and we can see where that is. You know, it gets you down there, I don't know, 5245, 5250 or something like that. That's what I'd be looking to press for. So stopping it at like 5330 or so and looking to press for a move down to kind of 5245 and play for a break and continue to move that stop lower, guy.
Well, I think that is correct. I think today's price action is interesting in terms of the sort of engulfing pattern that we're seeing in the S&P. We saw a similar pattern in individual stocks, I want to say three Fridays or so ago. I think that was March 8th. Please don't at me if I'm off by a day, but I believe that was the day. So, you know, just the armchair technicians will start to look at these things as well. And obviously, look, there's a lot of time left in the day. It's 2.5 hours left in the day. I don't want to make a huge deal out of it. But again, I point out that what is now the S&P down less than half of 1%, you're still seeing an outside moves in the VIX vis-a-vis the move you're seeing in the S&P. So, there are a lot of strange things happening. We started with yields for a reason. The technicals in terms of these S&P minis are very interesting, Dan Nathan, without question.
All right. Listen, unfortunately, Carter's not going to make it today. He will be on with us tomorrow, and we're going to do a deep dive on Google. That comes out Alphabet Guy. And we did a trade, a bullish trade idea using options. I think it was March 19th, and we were targeting a breakout. I think we said, like, you know, guys' expression, buy the breakout. Well, here we are. We are targeting a 155 strike, looking out a little bit here, and we're at 155. So we're gonna do that. We're gonna update that trade idea tomorrow with Carter. He's got a lot of good charts. But you mentioned this, Eli Lilly. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal today. So it seems like there's been no shortage of just positive story after positive story about these GLP-1s. Mm-hmm. Okay, so these diabetic drugs, these weight loss drugs. And so this article that I read, it was one of the first things I read this morning. It was kind of interesting. For a whole host of patients, it's not doing a whole heck of a lot, okay? And again, I think you should, you know, expect to see this sort of thing. I am no expert on this sort of stuff. For lots of patients, it's doing a lot of good work. So, you know, we've called this as one of these two mega trends that have just captivated the markets over the last kind of year and a half or so. And that is obviously generative AI and then these GLP-1s. Guy, the consolidation here after that kind of move late last year, breakout, right? The move off the uptrend, the breakout to new highs, the consolidation in this new range, it's pretty powerful. But thoughts here when you read a story like this after the stock has stopped going higher, let's be clear, over the last couple months.
Well, since February-ish, right? Late February, it's been going sideways, again, on a broader market, which is fine, by the way. I mean, it's not an indictment of the company, but you know, again, I've pointed this out a number of times. I mean, if you go longer term, if we pull up a real-time Eli Lilly chart, go a little longer term, you will see some, again, 30, 35, 40% moves from peak to trough along the way. Each time, obviously, it's been bought, but you've seen some violent moves to the downside. I mean, there was a move a while ago that felt like the entire story was over and people were leaving it for dead, only to get back on its horse. So it feels to me like this sideways action. Again, I think you're going to get, let's put it this way. If you watch Fast Money, Dan, you know this on our show, you know this. We have talked about, waxed poetic about Eli Lilly for years, long before GLP-1s were a thought in anybody's head. We continue to be positive. But what we've said recently, and I've been wrong, you know, I thought it would exhaust itself at some point and you'd get a pullback. But I'll say it again. You know, I think there's a very good chance that this thing exhausts itself and you get a much needed pullback in a company that's still doing amazing things. But I think it's gotten a bit ahead of itself.
Well, hey, listen, we on Fast Money have had guest after guest of companies that are in trials, smaller biotech companies that are looking to kind of build on the success of some of these drugs and apply it to different ailments and the like here. So there's been a lot of competition. Well, there hasn't been a lot of competition. There hopes to be a lot of competition. Carter mocked up these charts and I just kind of want to run through them here because you just talked about that kind of, you know, that kind of peak to trough action that has been, look at this, a 5-year chart. You see that very clearly well-defined up channel that it has been in. That last move that we just talked about, Guy, broke it out above that channel. Now, you could say that that prior resistance is now support, okay? Like, okay, I get it. So Carter draws an arrow on the next one, okay? He thinks that maybe that consolidation looks to be a little bit like a exhaustion, as you just kind of called it, over the last couple months or so. Now he puts in a line in the middle. Well, look at that. Well, you see where the support is, right? Which gets you down, I think.
Probably about 660-ish, but, you know, over time, each day it gets a little higher, but yeah.
660. And then look at this one. He draws an uptrend within that channel, which is kind of interesting. And then it brings you back, you know, towards your levels there that you're talking about. Like maybe it's a kind of retest of that 700 and gets you back to 650 or so, which might be a great time to kind of reload if you're looking to get back in the story. But I think the point that you just made before we even looked at Carter's charts is that the stock prior to the ramp last year has given you the opportunity to get back in at different parts of the story and, you know, for fundamental reasons in life.
A number of times without question. But before we get out of here, we got a couple questions. And Amanda, JM460, with rates up, would you put XHB, would you put puts on an XHB and or ITB? So a couple things. The XHB is equal weighted ETF. I think they're all like anywhere between 4 and 4.5%, the holdings-ish. Companies you've heard of, some companies you haven't heard of. So I'm more a fan, if you were to do that, to do it in the ITB, which is more skewed towards individual names. I think DHI, between DHI, Lennar, and NVR, I think you're talking about 35% or so of the ETF. So if you think yields are going higher and they're going to present a bit of a headwind here, that's the one you play it in, I think, Dan, not the XHB. But that's just my opinion.
Well, I'll just say this. I mean, I'm looking at the May puts, and let's just say you thought rates were going to push to 4.5% in the 10-year, like really quickly. With the ETF trading at like 114, the 114 puts in May, again, that's May 17th expiration. We're April 1st, so we have a month and a half or so. It would cost you maybe $3.60 or so. You can do the math on that. You know, that's less than 3% or something like that. So, you know, if you, let's just say they cost $4 and you're buying the 114s, your break even's at 110, you see where this thing has been over the last few months. I mean, there was that nice long consolidation, but it broke out above 110. So 110 seems like a good level, you know what I mean, to play for to the downside. It's also, if you could just draw an uptrend from those October lows, that's basically breaking that. And then you maybe have a move back towards $100. So the end of the day, to me, great question. And that could be a way to play it. And Guy, maybe tomorrow, tomorrow.
But we also said real quick, what we're looking at, we're on the Instagram, as you mentioned, each and every day. And we put this on the gram earlier today. One of the things that I was looking at was CCJ, Cameco or Cameco, depending on how you pronounce it. Again, the symbol is CCJ. Goldman Sachs, $55 price target. I think they're spot on. And we've talked about, you know, this basically secular shift. I mean, there are some secular stories out there that make sense. So this happens to be one of them. Amanda, real quick, if you could put up a long-term chart in CCJ, you'll see why that $55 level makes a lot of sense, at least to me and clear to Goldman Sachs as well. So, you know, uranium and some of these, especially if the crude move continues, which I do think it will, we'll talk about that again. I think you're going to start seeing some strength in some of these underlying names. And we need even longer term than that. You'll see exactly what I'm looking at. And CCJ is one of them. There you go.
There you go. Wow. Interesting. How do you pronounce it? Cameco or Cameco?
I'm a Cameco person, but I know heard people say Cameco. So
yeah. All right. What I was looking at this morning. So there was a lot of green, Guy. It seemed like the, you know, investors came in, you know, long holiday weekend. They wanted to buy stocks. There was some stuff they saw, I guess, on the macro front, I guess that they saw on single stock land was kind of interesting. There was an article in the information. This is a tech rag that I read every morning. It's a very good rag here. It was, the headline was Microsoft and OpenAI plot $100 billion Stargate AI supercomputer, Guy. Supercomputer, $100 billion. That's a lot of GPUs. The SMH was up 2%, led by Micron. It was up more than 6.5%. Taiwan Semi was up nearly 5% at one point. It was interesting because, again, it just seems like there's no shortage of headlines that just seem so positive. It seems like there is no end in sight for demand for for the GPUs to train the large language models and the multimodal models. And then they're going to go into these supercomputers that are going to now cost $100 billion, guy. And then, as Sam Altman was saying a couple months ago, they need to raise trillions of dollars.
Yeah, not you billions, know, $7 trillion. And we had Kara Swisher on Computer, I believe. Yep. And she said, no, actually, $7 trillion is light. She thought it needed to be significantly more than that. Point being, the numbers are getting a little ridiculous. And again, I think what you're seeing here, and I can't speak to the analyst community, but you have people trip over themselves to try to be who can be the most optimistic and the most bullish and come up with the most interesting bend on a story that we hear now seemingly each and every day.
Yeah, and that's kind of the point. And if Amanda wants to quickly do the chart, you love this chart, like the 10-year of the SMH. You know, we were looking at that double top at 160, guy. Remember how cute that was?
And it, you know what? It actually held up. I mean, if you go back and look, you know, the first time up to that 163 level ish in the, I guess in the fall or so, stopped. And then it actually sold off below 140, I believe. Yeah. And then when we finally got to it the third time, it was off to the races. But for that very short period of time, couple months maybe, that actual double top work. Now, the question is, what happens from here? I'm on record. I'll say it again. You know, I think we revisit that 163 to 165 level.
Yeah. Again, you know, NVIDIA is 20% of the SMH. Taiwan Semi is about 12%. And Broadcom is nearly 8%. So, you know, you do the math. This rally is becoming narrower and narrower in the semis here. So, you know, it makes me nervous. This cannot go unchecked, in my opinion. But, you know, again, it's been doing that for months and months now. All right, guys, that's what we covered on the Insta. Be sure to follow us there. We'll give a little preview of what we're doing on Market Call every day. Obviously, we got a lot of great stuff going on the Risk Reversal Media website here. You go check that out. You can sign up for our newsletter there. You can see, you get the show notes, you get the charts, you get the show notes in your email box.
It's free. Why wouldn't you? I mean,
before you even go do the thing, you know, before you, they're right there for you, guy. So they know what we're going to do before we do it.
And as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of sporting events tonight. The Rangers, I believe, are at home against the Penguins of Pittsburgh. You're going. Good for you. Knicks lost last night. Tough game to Oklahoma City. Oklahoma played well. Good for them. The Mets are playing the Tigers at Shea tonight. Good luck with that. Yankees are in Arizona. But the sporting event that I will be watching, guaranteed.
Oh, yeah.
The Iowa Women Hawkeyes against the LSU Tigers. That is going to be must-watch television, folks. So I know these girls can play. And I guarantee you're going to see I'm willing to say that 7 million people may tune in to watch this game tonight.
So this is a rematch of last year's national championship. Mm-hmm. And Caitlin Clark came out on the losing end of that. But they look like Iowa's a better team this year. Is that right, guy?
Iowa's a little bit better this year. LSU is a little bit worse than they were last year, but I don't think it matters tonight. I mean, these are two well-coached teams. They got ladies that can absolutely flat-out play, and it's going to be a fun game to watch.
All right, fair enough. And again, you know, kudos to your Yankees sweeping the Houston Astros 4-0. I mean, talk about that, okay? So how about it? You should be a happy man. You should be a very – hey, by the way, really quickly.
Year to year, baby.
Have you been watching – did you watch the Sweet 16? Did you watch a bunch of basketball this weekend?
No.
So one of the network – must be maybe AT&T or something. They have Jalen Brunson on an ad. You haven't seen that where he's, like, taping all the smartphones onto his shirt so we can watch all the different games? You haven't seen that or no? Okay.
No, at the end of it,
dude, you got to see this commercial because you're going to love it. Because at the end of it, Brunson looks at his wife. She's in the commercial. He goes, "I am a vibe." And it's just a great line. If you see it, you will.
Let me tell you something.
I know you do. And you're
Jalen Brunson. He is, you know, I'd say in my pantheon of Knicks, he's in the top five now. I just love everything. Not because he scores a lot, it's a way he plays. And his attitude. I just love everything about him. He is a stud.
Didn't you grow up?
The flip side of that coin, by the way, is Carmelo Anthony, who might be my most hated Knick of all time.
Yeah. Well, he's also been very prominently displayed in AT&T commercial this whole this whole thing. All right, guy. You are a vibe.
That's it. I'm a vibe. We'll be back tomorrow. I don't know who's with us tomorrow because
Carter's with us.
God only knows, but Carter might be with us. But thanks for tuning in today, folks. Enjoy the rest of your day. Enjoy the sports tonight. We'll talk to you later.